Welcome to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. And today we have the honor of John Van Auken being here with us. He's just back from Egypt, and we are going to be hearing stories about Edgar Cayce, Ra-Ta, maybe even Atlantis. And so join us for this interesting conversation with John Van Auken. Thanks for being here, John. I know you just got back. I know you've probably, how many times have you been to Egypt?
Let's see, it's in the 40s, but I don't recall exactly. You know, when I first went, I only thought that'd be the one time I'd go.
Really?
So I'm shocked that it's in the 40s.
Oh, I had so much fun when we used to go. I think we went about 5 or 7 times together. Those were really, really good times.
They were.
So where should we start? I mean, we got so much here to go on. Do you want to start with, I know you have some slides or some pictures from your last trip. Why don't we
I thought I'd share some of the Egypt tour. This is cruising down the Nile.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yes, that's beautiful.
It's so pastoral
and
pleasant. And that's me with my cell phone hanging out the window of the cruise boat.
That's great.
And you know, these cruise boats are the river style that the British made, wood and brass and really beautiful.
And so your group had the whole boat, right?
We had the whole boat because there was enough of us to rent a whole boat. And that's a banana orchard there with a donkey grazing. They use donkey power a lot. Those palm trees are date palms. They don't have coconut palms, date palms.
Yeah, I remember the stops along the way.
Yeah.
And there was the crocodile temple was one of the stops.
Right.
There were, and I remember we'd go into the town, and then I remember seeing these old mills where the horses would pull the mills.
That's
and you
right,
would,
yeah.
Extract the oil that way.
There's a water buffalo. It's very pastoral and beautiful and so serene. You relax, and like you have the group with
nice.
You, so there's lots of social time on the boat, which is always fun because people make the tour as well as the environment.
I'm so glad that Egypt has opened up again because
me too.
What was it, about 5 years? That
2012, we stopped going.
Okay, so about 7 years it was stopped.
Yeah, and you can't get away from the salesman. These guys tied their boat to our cruise boat. Now watch this guy throw the galabeah. Galabeah is a dress and he's trying to sell them.
I remember that. I remember I was playing catch because he'd throw it to me and I'd say, no, I'd throw it back and he'd throw it back.
Right. Yeah. Now he's showing a tablecloth that he wants to try to sell. This is the party on the boat. We always have a galabeah. And as you can see, this is me and my niece, Kirsten.
Oh, wow. That's
and we're
nice.
In our galabeahs.
That's a beautiful piece she has on her neck.
Yeah, yeah. And the party's about to begin. These guys on the tour are already claiming their drinks, an alcoholic and non-alcoholic.
Okay, good.
And these are all the scenes, you know, the Great Pyramid in the upper right corner there, the Sphinx, of course, the camel rides.
Mm-hmm.
We're inside temples here on the bottom photos. That's a museum shot on the upper left there. We're inside the Egyptian Museum. Now we're in tombs, and you remember how painted they are.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, and the symbolism.
And I remember you knew tombs that nobody else goes to. I remember, is it Senechin's tomb?
Yeah.
He was the artisan who would work in daytime
at
the Valley of the Kings, and at night he made his own tomb.
That's right,
and
beautiful spiritual teachings in those tombs. Here we are, you know, it's amazing. We're number one tour of Egypt.
That's great.
And old friends. It was a great tour. Now, interestingly, we don't just do ancient Egypt. This is the crypt in which Mary and Joseph hid baby Jesus from Herod while he was killing all the children. They fled to Egypt through a dream.
Yes, I remember that,
And so we visited this little spot. You had to go down, as you can see, she's going down ahead of me. And I'm doing this with my cell phone, too. So that was nice to touch on the origins of Christianity there. And of course, here's sunset on the Nile.
That's beautiful.
It is,
it really is. Now what are some, I mean, you take experienced travelers and you take novices with you to Egypt. What do you set as the foundation? What do you think that is a good place for people to start with an understanding of Edgar Cayce's take on Egypt?
Well, they know already that Casey talked a lot about past lives in Egypt, mm-hmm. and how many souls that, like this organization, were among
yes.
those souls in ancient Egypt. And so they have it deep inside them, and when they see imagery from Egypt, it draws them, you know?
I remember you had said that sometimes there's the king's men, and yeah. then there's Rata, the priest's men,
or
people.
Yeah.
And that sometimes those issues come up
yeah.
from those
yeah.
past life influences.
Yeah, that's very true. It's human nature, politics, and spirituality sometimes bump heads, and sometimes they work together.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you think about, like, Egypt in its heyday? What was it serving? Or what does it serve any way? I've thought of it as kind of a paradigm for soul evolution. Like you've said, oftentimes there was this kind of descent into the physical, and then kind of hopefully now we're on the ascent
right.
kind of into the spiritual.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you see that playing out in the Egyptian story?
Well, in the Edgar Casey reading of the Akashic Record or the Book of Life, mm-hmm. he says, Egypt came as a result of the fall of Lemuria and Atlantis.
Ah.
And so the population of the earth dropped. And if you look in Genesis in chapter 6, God washes the earth clean with a great flood and regrets having made the first creation. So this is known as the second. And the souls now want to come in with a fresh start. And Egypt is one of the sacred locations around the planet. There were several.
Mm. It was like a touch point of the second spiritual evolution. Into
absolutely.
The earth.
And yeah. so all souls came in as teachers, initiates, and built these temple activities and tried to build a political structure that would allow spirituality to function well. And so Edgar explains that many of our souls actually went through the initiations in these temples back then,
mm-hmm.
and we contributed to the beauty and glory of ancient Egypt, the artwork, the building of pyramids. All of this was a part of our experience over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Casey has Egypt running about 10,000 years BC.
Mm-hmm.
Most archaeologists would find that a stretch, you know, mm-hmm. 3,000. But now they're finding, because of Göbekli Tepe
yes.
up in Turkey, 11,000 BC. Now they're going, wait a minute, it could be older, you know. So all of this is active, dynamic, exciting, and so people want to go and retouch. The great thing about touring Egypt is, like if you go to Greece, they will show you the foundation or parts of the temple.
Mm-hmm.
This is where it was.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Egypt, there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, it's still standing, the pyramids and the temples.
Now, with so much that has changed in 12,000 years, when you go to Egypt, is there a place, or you know, what's one of the main places where you feel that somehow it's retained a lot of its spiritual integrity? Is that in the pyramid and the...
Yeah, I tell you the truth, Peter. All of the areas. The Great Pyramid certainly has mm-hmm. the vibes and the energy.
Mm-hmm.
The temples still have the magic, and the walls are covered with mm-hmm. spiritual teachings.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go to the colorful tombs, and as you're walking, here's a whole story of the journey of the souls
mm-hmm.
Practically everywhere. But then you get into nature along the Nile River,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah,
you also have that serenity, that yeah. pastoral thing, plus you get to have fellowship with fellow travelers of like-mindedness.
And what was Casey's take on the use of the Great Pyramid? You know, I guess he used different words, the chamber of the second birth, and then I guess the king's chamber, the queen's chamber.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a very involved. It's amazing how diverse the layout inside the Great Pyramid is towards soul initiation and growth.
Mm-hmm.
And he, and of course many others before him, said that the Book of the Dead correlates to certain chambers in the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
And books were published about that, including David Davidson's great book in the early 1900s. Well, Edgar was asked about Davidson's book, and he said, for the most part, it's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that helps you understand that the Queen's Chamber was actually called, in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Chamber of the Second Birth, which is what Jesus said to Nicodemus, you have to be born again a second time. And that's your spiritual birth. You've been born physically.
And what's the King's Chamber called?
The open tomb, Chamber of the Open Tomb. There really is no death to the soul.
So you go through the second birth first, and then you
birth
go to
your
the
spiritual
open tomb.
Nature, then go up and learn that you are the spiritual one. You're just traveling in the body temporarily, 80 to 100 years, but you're going to live beyond the body.
Oh, how interesting. That's fascinating. Well, I know we have some folks that are watching us live, and they have some questions. So here's a question. What did Edgar Cayce say about the Hall of Records? Why hasn't it been found just yet?
The Atlanteans became aware that their era was ending. And so they wanted to record the descent of the children of God out of the heavens into matter, into the earth realm. And they knew they were going to lose celestial awareness as they made that transition, that there was going to be a veil between their outer mind and their deeper mind. So they carved three sets of stone tablets telling the story. And they hid them in three locations on the planet. And one of them is off the right front paw of the Sphinx in beneath the ground. And so that Hall of Records, we have checked it out. You know, ARE, since going way back to the 60s, has done research looking for it. But Edgar said it wouldn't be found until the hearts and minds of humanity were in the right place. Then it would be discovered. He was asked, will it be in hieroglyphics that'll be difficult to translate? He said it'll be in Atlantean hieroglyphics, but relatively easy to translate. Won't take as long as it has with the Dead Sea Scrolls, which took 11 years, you know.
Yeah, and I remember one of the last times we went together, it was just before that the Arab Spring came. And did you have a feeling that there were we were getting close to discovering it? I always wondered if that was, in that time, there was a withdrawal. Like, because it seemed like the Zahi Hawass was open, they were doing a lot of drilling, and they were finding that water. It seemed like there was progress being made, and then it just stopped for, I guess, for 7 years.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you think that was somehow, people were getting too close?
Yeah. It wasn't time.
Yeah. And we're I know Piedras Negras is another place that they made
in Guatemala.
Yeah, and I guess that place has become shut off because of the drug movement down the river. So that's
right.
Another. So
yeah.
It just seems I guess we're still touching into these places. No, that's okay.
So I've been traveling so much. I have a bad cough.
Oh, I remember those. How long is it? 8 to 10 hour flights.
11.
11. Yeah. Yeah.
So. The other location is off the coast of Bimini in the Bahamas.
Yeah, so we're still, it's almost like we're getting close, but like you said, I guess the consciousness of humanity.
So, I see the question, the Temple Beautiful and the Temple Sacrifice.
Yeah.
Edgar explained that when they designed the training, they designed two temples. One was the Temple Sacrifice, to improve the human body to a higher vibration. And he said that was like a...
just get you some more water here.
Thank you. That was like a spa combined with a hospital. And then the Temple Beautiful was like a monastery and a university combined to improve the heart and mind. So initiates would go through the Temple Sacrifice to get their spiritual centers right, their chakras, the vibrations of their body, and to raise the life force in the body. Then they would go into the Temple Beautiful and illuminate the heart and mind.
Now they could teach. Sacrifice was to kind of remove things, and then Beautiful was to kind of add things or spiritualize things?
Remove earthiness.
Yeah.
Earthy things, because see, the first creation, the immersion into matter became so materialistic, so self-gratifying, that had to be stopped. So they shifted into training the body to have a higher vibe. Mm-hmm. And that higher vibe meant you had to eliminate some of your egocentric desires, your physical attributes that were too earthy, mm-hmm. such as animalistic urges and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then once you had mastered that, you could go into the Temple Beautiful and have illumination. In the Temple Beautiful, it was specifically taught that you could learn everything, but that wouldn't matter if you didn't have the right heart. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of tests in the Temple Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Even though you were wise and understood the truth, where was your heart really? Mm-hmm. In the Eastern world, they say the bird of paradise has two wings. Mm-hmm. One wing is the right knowledge and technique. The other's the right heart. Mm-hmm. And the bird doesn't fly with one wing.
Yeah, and there are those beautiful hieroglyphics that you point out where your heart is weighed against a feather.
Oh, yeah.
And it must be lighter than a feather.
Lighter than a feather. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Ratha, in the story of his life, he was feeling older, and then he went into these temples for 7 years. Did he go through both? Was that the process where he rejuvenated himself?
Now, that story is very interesting because Ratha was banished for a period of time because he broke his own rule.
Yes.
And he made up for it and all, but the people wanted him back. When they brought him back, he was 100 years old and decrepit is what the reading said. Mm-hmm. But he knew there was work to do. So he went into his main spiritual temple, not the sacrifice or the beautiful temple.
Oh, it was his own temple.
His own temple.
Oh, okay.
And Edgar was asked in the reading, what did Ratha do to rejuvenate himself? And he said, a very important teaching that my wife and I held to for a long time. He let go of the things that had aged him.
Oh, my.
Oh, we hold on to those, you
know. That's true.
So Doris and I tried so hard to stop remembering the regrets, the disappointments, any bitterness or any lasting sort of attitudinal, emotional junk we were carrying, you know. Get rid of that. Then he used musical instruments, strings and wind instruments to renew his body, and they would play it and he would tune his spiritual centers to the instruments.
That's great.
And that helped his body.
Sometimes I've tried to think about that, how to explain it to people, and I think that, you know, all of our life experiences are, you know, they're learning experiences, and eventually we gain the gifts of it. Like you go to school and you get the diploma.
Right.
But some people, like when you go to a school, you keep the diploma and you don't necessarily remember how hard school was and all the tragedies that are the difficulties.
Yeah.
But it's like sometimes people forget the diploma and they just carry the school around with them.
Yeah.
I think those are the things that age us.
Yeah. You don't realize what your subconscious is carrying, mm-hmm. you know, and you start to bend lower and lower as you get older and older. Got to let go of some of that.
Yeah, and I guess that's the connection with forgiving and forgetting.
Yes.
That process, forgetting really is a kind of a letting go.
Right.
Because otherwise, what good is it if you keep remembering something that's toxic?
That's
Those
right.
Those are the things we have to let
and,
go
and
of.
And that concept of as you sow, so you reap. Well, if you sow memory and regret and attitudes, that's what you keep getting. If you let go of those, if you forgive, forget, you lighten up, and then your heart is light enough to be weighed against a feather.
Yeah, yeah. I've thought that it's like it's a universal teaching that like the physical body, like Casey said, it'll live as long as the body can assimilate nutrients and eliminate toxins.
Exactly.
And we have to do that not just in the body, on the level of the mind and spiritually, kind of let go of the toxic stuff.
Absolutely.
And keep the good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Doris and I got to where we were watching our thoughts. And when a pattern of habit just comes up the way we think all the time, mm-hmm. we would stop it and say, wait a minute, that's a negative thought. That's a judgment thought. Change that thinking pattern.
Yeah, and I think you can eventually start to notice when those come in. Like, you know, like they say, people get hangry. I just notice if I'm tired or hungry, that it feeds into that negative pattern. It's almost like you have to do some self-care.
Self-care.
To stay in the positivity.
And be mindful of what you're doing mm-hmm. mentally.
Yeah, definitely.
Who is Ratha?
And what is his relationship with Edgar Cayce?
Well, that's a simple
one.
As you know, Edgar Cayce was teaching us all about past lives and incarnations, and the purpose was soul growth. Mm-hmm. So our soul, not our personality out here, this is fresh and new.
Yes.
And my mother can assure you I was naive as a child, mm-hmm. but my soul is on a journey of illumination and growth, and it has incarnations. And one of Edgar Cayce's greatest incarnations was as a high priest in ancient Egypt called Ra-Ta, which translates basically light and earth, or sun and matter, light and earth. So the blend of the two.
It's like Emmanuel, God in the physical.
Emmanuel, God among us. Yeah,
yes.
Very similar to that concept. But don't compare him to Emmanuel. I'm not doing that.
Fair enough.
Right.
Now, having been with you again several times to Egypt, I know that when you're explaining the hieroglyphics and giving your lectures, I know much of it is from Cayce's readings, but so much of it seems intuitive. And so much of it just seems like you're awakening your own soul memory about Egypt. Could you speak with that? Are you able to share any of your own past life memories or your own intuitive downloads of Egypt?
See, studying Edgar Cayce, when I first read my first book at 16 years of age, and my father was a naval officer who retired here.
Yeah.
So I was set up. I got my driver's license, read a book on Cayce, and here I am, Virginia Beach. And studying it, I came to be aware of this idea that there was a part of me behind a veil that separated the two parts of me that had experiences beyond this life. Mm-hmm. And so I kept open to that. And they would come through dreams, through intuition and all. And I got to a point where I became aware of an ancient Egyptian incarnation of myself related with Ra-Ta. Mm-hmm. And so that helped me get that. But Edgar said, take it further. All that information's not lost. It's in you. Mm-hmm. But it's in you in a different language than your normal outer thinking and sentence structure and all. It's in this sort of inner knowing, this intuitive knowing. And if you start to get a feel for that, it comes again. So I would literally, on my first trip to Egypt, I would look at a wall on a temple and go, oh my gosh, I know what this means. I feel what this means.
Right.
And then gradually that kept getting bigger and bigger the more I kept involving myself with it. And I ended up writing 4 books on Egypt.
Yeah, that comes across when you're there. You're just, the way that you're reading what's there, like it's in English. Like you're,
every soul is this way. Mm-hmm. All of the people watching and all, deep within them, latent within them, is what Edgar said, is all this wisdom and understanding.
Now, one of the things I've felt with traveling personally and also going on ARE tours is that it seems that when you go to a certain country, and you go kind of as a seeker, a spiritual intention, it seems like you get more downloads. Like I remember going to Israel, I felt much more kind of understanding of Jesus' story.
Yeah.
Have you felt that in Egypt?
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel like when you're there, you get
a
kind of a clarity or?
Everywhere I've led an ARE tour, that happens at some point. Mm-hmm. You have the magic of the fellowship traveling together, like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Mm-hmm. Pilgrims on a way get to touch one another, and it brings out things in that. But also you're in the vibe. You're in the zone of where it really happened. Mm-hmm. And so Ireland, England, Scotland, Europe, China and Tibet. I've been doing China and Tibet. These things help bring it out and tap a little bit, and then it starts to flow. Yeah, it's very helpful. You don't have to be there because Edgar Cayce never went to Egypt.
Right.
And yet he had all that knowledge flowing through. So don't feel bad if you can't go. It's latent within you to access. If you just budget a little time, you can go.
And be there. That reminds me of how there was a reading where Cayce says that you don't have to find the physical Hall of Records.
No.
That you can, they're in consciousness, that you can tap into them. Have you tapped into the Hall of Records yourself, or anything that you could share about what might be important, particularly to this time that we're living through, of kind of this, mean, it's, I know your book, 2038, you know, you're talking about, you know, 1958 to 1998,
yeah.
And now we're in the 1998 to 2038 40-year
right.
period. Any thoughts, any intuit, anything you're getting
yeah.
you can share about that?
Well, I first got this idea that that would be possible when Edgar was giving a discourse to a young man, and he said, he would like to know what's inside the Hall of Records. And Edgar calmly said, well, I'm standing there now. What would you like to know? And I thought, wait a minute. So if I still the body like Edgar did,
yes.
and I practice expanding into the collective consciousness, nowhere is not accessible.
Mm-hmm.
It's all accessible. If you practice and learn how to do it. So yes, a few times I actually have felt tapped into it as though some aspect of my mental body, my soul body was there. And it was like a knowing coming from nowhere, you know, it just came to you.
Uh-huh.
And so, and that's helped write those books, believe uh-huh. me. There are times in those books when you're looking at a blank page going, man, what's next, you know? And,
now, my thought about the Hall of Records is that in the whole depth and breadth of the Casey material, what's in the Hall of Records is basically laid out. And I think that when it comes into public eye, it might be new for a lot of people, but I think for people within that have been students of the readings, it won't be that much new that's there. A little bit like with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. I think that Casey had kind of previewed a lot of what was there that was new to the world, but you know, about like the Essenes being
yeah.
women being teachers there. There were mm-hmm. a number of that was kind of groundbreaking for
it was
for kind of conventional history,
yeah.
but it had been Casey had tapped into that and shared it.
Yeah.
Is that your thought? Do you think that is there anything very, very radically new that would be found in the Hall of Records?
Casey actually says all the souls incarnating right now have access to knowing the truth.
Mm-hmm.
They're all carrying it. Even the somewhat negative ones can feel it near. You know, you get a feeling that there's a knowing, and so outer actions better start to fit inner truths,
yes.
or this is going to create a real serious problem.
Yeah.
You can't be hypocritical knowing one thing and doing another, you know? So,
darn.
Yeah.
Busted.
Yeah. Let's see. Could it be that the boat used in ancient images to represent the soul's vehicle represents the human form as well? Now, do you see that means that soul already knows that's true?
Mm-hmm.
It's latent in that soul is that reality.
Yeah, the truth comes in, and then it comes into the doubting mind. And so I better ask John and double check.
Oh, I doubt if this person's doubting. They know
they
that's
know
true.
Yes,
yeah, so around the Great Pyramid is the great Pharaoh boat. And the fascinating thing on that boat is that the navigator mm-hmm. is your ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Your ideal determines where that boat's going.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not conscious of your ideal, you just drift with the current of the river. But if you start to become aware of your, what really do you want to do with your life? And suddenly you take the rudder. And the navigator takes hold of the rudder, and the current is not the master, you are.
Yeah.
And Edgar was really big about that.
So that's the using the will. To kind of steer the boat.
And certain aspects of the boat reflect certain aspects of your physical body.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a true good understanding of the sacred boat. It was called the sacred boat.
Yeah, and I remember when you go to Egypt, they found one of them, there are two of them, and they're both kind of like airproof. Somehow they've used stone to keep them in a vacuum because the one that's on display is in perfect condition and it's thousands yeah. and thousands of years old.
Thousands of years old.
And there's another one they're leaving right underground.
Yeah, because the Egyptians
yeah.
could seal things so
right.
perfectly.
When this one breaks down, they can break out the other one.
That's right.
They have a backup.
Yeah.
Backup plan.
How were the pyramids built, boy? This is a question everybody's written books about and tried to guess and wonder.
We're called pyramid idiots, I know.
Yeah, pyramid idiots for all of our ideas. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard everything and I've looked at it and I've read everyone's attitude or perspective on it. Mm-hmm. It is difficult to say how 2,300,000 stones perfectly cut, put perfectly together, in which you can't even get a razor blade
it's
between.
It's amazing. I don't know anything about, you know, construction or archaeology, I mean, or architecture, but I know in the King's Chamber, you close your eyes and you put your hand down the wall, you don't feel the seams. It's like, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And those stones are how many tons?
Oh, yeah.
Just like perfectly placed. And there's, like you said, no mortar.
No.
It's just, I mean, and some of the tours, we'd have these engineers and they'd say, we couldn't build this today. This is absolutely amazing. And they would point out to me things. They say, you know, okay, maybe this is 2,000 years old. Maybe it's 10,000. But it says, look at that. Look at the perfect alignment.
Right.
Even now, this many thousands of years, how many earthquakes have happened
that
these temples stay aligned?
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
It
is a wonder.
Do you think that...
What was the purpose of the Sphinx? Boy, the Sphinx is a mystery, isn't it? There's been a lot written about it, going way back to the Orion Mystery Book, in which the Sphinx is looking toward the east, and most perfectly around the age of Leo, which is roughly 10,005, which is Edgar Casey's.
So that's a little bit of kind of alignment of that. It is his theory isn't out of nowhere.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the three pyramids appear to be two inline and one offline, which is exactly the way the stars in the belt of Orion are. So a lot of people thought that was
that it's connected.
Some alignment, and that and Edgar said Giza was laid out according to the stars. So here's the Sphinx facing east at the time that Edgar said it all really started. Then the pyramids appear to be having a feature of one set off that's so similar to the Belt of Orion. As far as understanding the meaning of the Sphinx, there's a lot of information on it, but it seems like he's saying it's from an ancient period when there were no humans here, and yet humans tried to push their way into matter, therefore they touched the animal kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
so that
why
animal, half human, half animal.
Right.
Being.
That's where mythology of half horse, half man,
the mermaids,
half fish,
like
half woman, all of this. And so he seems to indicate that was a stone structure to represent that previous period that wasn't proper, wasn't the way nature wanted things to be. And so you had to develop a human body.
Let me backtrack a second, though, just to something we were talking about earlier. You wrote the book 2038.
Yeah.
And you're looking at the pyramid inch and the measurement of time.
Right.
What are your thoughts about, because you know, 1958 to 1998 was a 40-year period that Casey spoke about. Now we're in that 40-year period, 1998 to 2038.
Uh-huh.
What are your insights about, we're all living in that time. We're all moving towards 2038, which I guess is the calendar of the pyramid ends at that time, at 2038?
Yes, Edgar Casey said the pyramid was laid out with a secret chronogram in it. And that was the journey of the children into matter and back out. And at the apex above the King's Chamber where the stones meet, that's the end of the pyramid timeline prophecy. And he said a new body type will develop, and the evolution of the body will move to where it has 12 chakras. And of course, someone asked him, what are the other spiritual centers? And he said, why would you want to know? You're not using the seven, you know? So be careful.
I think I asked that question.
Oh, you did? So I don't think it's the end of an era or anything. Like, for example, the Mayan prophecy everybody thought was the end of the world because the media wanted to sell that.
Right.
But that's not what the Mayan prophecy was. Yeah. Even Boston University showed, they found a chronogram, a Mayan calendar underneath the ground.
That goes well past 2012.
It goes well past 2012, yeah. But the media didn't want to publish that. That was found in February of 2012, but you know, they didn't want to publish it, so they didn't. And here we are, December 21st, 2012, everybody wondering what's going to happen.
Life
continued on.
It's like New Year's Day.
Yeah, but it was a new era beginning. Mm-hmm. It's a sign, and the stars are getting in position. So I think 2038 is another transition period for the evolution of humanity back into its true nature, which is celestial beings temporarily incarnating terrestrially.
And do you feel that overlaps with the book of Revelation prophecies, the way Casey interpreted it?
Yes.
In the times that we're living in?
Yeah, Casey's interpretation of the Revelation would fit with that sort of theory. It also fits well with the Mayan myths and legends.
Because as I go around the country, it seems that the ARE folks and New Age folks are just trying to understand the complex times that we're living in. You know, it's like the New Age, and it's supposed to be this dawn of all these great things, and people look around and they're like, whoa, this doesn't look like this heyday of humanity.
No,
and so how do you reconcile that there is a hope, but there just seems like we're kind of going through some...
Edgar says we're still in that Armageddon period of the forces of the dark and the light still wrestling for control of the hearts and minds of humanity. So you have tremendous good going on and tremendous bad. Yet the Armageddon is accomplished by the light forces overthrowing the dark forces eventually. And I don't mean that in a war sense or a physical battle sense, but in understanding, love, heart and mind awareness, and caring for one another. And you can see this starting to happen, because right now in the world, you can't have a group of people starving to death without the rest of the group throwing food at them, you know?
Right, yes.
Or if you get into a battle and there's a war going on between factions, the rest of the world is going to stick their nose into your battle and try to break it up. There's a lot of that going on. So I don't think we're there yet. You're right, it does overlap.
Yeah.
So the goodness is coming, the higher vibrations are coming, higher concepts of understanding and mindfulness, but still there's the ego and power and the old ways are still battling to hold on.
And sometimes I've thought of Egypt in its heyday as kind of being like, you know, we have ideals that are spiritual levels of consciousness, and I've thought that Egypt in its spiritual heyday, kind of for folks, because so many people resonate with Egypt, not just as a place, but as a energy or a consciousness. And I wonder if Egypt is kind of in the subconscious of people as the possibility for the human and soul connection and with each other. Have you felt that there's almost if you meditate or dwell upon Egypt, not just as a physical place, but as a spiritual reality, is that part of what you think is people tap into when they go there?
Well, I think the number one thing that attracts people is the amazing culture of ancient Egypt, the art, the beauty. The Nile back then fed the whole country, and it was a high level of civilization. So that attracts them. But then they start to look at the mysteries, and that lingers in their subconscious, their deeper mind. The mysteries are fascinating, and their soul has been there. So all of this starts to build on the importance of Egypt to their hearts and minds. Mm. I just took a large group of Chinese to Egypt, and they loved it. And they were meditating in the Great Pyramid. They were high. I mean, so it's in the hearts and minds of everybody around the planet.
I remember doing a 3-hour meditation in the Great Pyramid on a tour, and people were chanting. The vibe was so high.
So high.
That when I left there, I gave away everything I had. I gave away my money. I gave away my watch to the people. And about 2 hours later, I woke up and I go, oh my God, glad I had my, didn't have my passport with me. And I came back into the physical.
Yeah.
But that's the next question is about, this woman says that meditating the Great Pyramid was a highlight of her life. Can you tell us some of your experiences or perhaps some of the experiences that people have shared with you meditating in the Great Pyramid?
Yeah, we've had many. Back when I initially used to lead tours, we would go multiple times, but you can't do that anymore.
Even overnight, man. These people used to
stay
overnight.
Yeah, we used to go overnight until somebody carved Bob Loves Linda, and that was the end of
Bob
that.
Bob Loves Casey.
Yeah. So, I guess one, there have been so many. I mean, there's so many experiences, but I guess one that's very interesting is we all were in the Grand Gallery and we sat down on the steps and we chanted.
Yes.
And the acoustics are phenomenal.
Yes.
So your voice is getting feedback voice.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The resonance is unbelievable. So we're getting high. Then we all get up and go in the King's Chamber and we all sit down to meditate or lie down. And after I lead them through the Egyptian Book of the Dead and a little prep work, we get quiet. So we're all quiet. And then suddenly we start to hear singing above us, like angels.
Wow.
And so I come to, and my first earthy thought is, darn, the guards are singing. And I realize, the guards don't sing. What are you thinking about? So I listen down the passageway. They are not singing.
Yeah.
They're not even talking down there. They're just standing out there. So then I realized, oh my gosh, the location's above us.
Yeah.
And that moved all of us.
Wow. So everyone heard it?
Everyone heard it. It was very moving. I mean, it really affected us.
Wow.
Other times I was meditating with the group when suddenly I found myself beyond the Great Pyramid out into the celestial realm, which was called the Duat by the Egyptians. Wow. Apparently, above the pyramid is the reverse pyramid that expands you out into infinity from finite. And so, wow, I was there and I realized, wow, this is my normal natural condition. Infinite, universal. But I'm temporarily finite individual. But I'm both.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to balance. And I thought, this might have been the initiation in this chamber and I was getting to touch it again. There are many experiences there.
Yeah. I have fond memories of that experience. Well, here's a question about the Emerald Stone.
Yeah.
Is that
the
Egyptian?
Emerald Tablets of Thoth or Hermes? Depends how you read it, the Greek or the Egyptian. The Emerald Tablets are, it is said on the walls in Egypt that the Emerald Tablets are hidden somewhere in Giza on the plateau. And the archaeologists know this, they're aware of this. They have not found anything that they claim to be those emerald tablets. And you know, some people believe they would hide the fact. That isn't true at all. If they found them, man, they'd be right in front of National Geographic cameras right away. So that's a suspicion that's a waste of time. In fact, when they discovered the subterranean chamber of Osiris' tomb, it was big news, cameras, everything. So they wouldn't hide anything like that, but they are aware of them. Now, do they correlate to the Atlantean stone tablets, the emerald tablets of Thoth or Hermes? Maybe, I don't know. Not on the walls, they just say, the emerald tablets are hidden somewhere on the Giza Plateau. Now, Casey indicates that the Atlantean tablets are written on stone. And I think if it was emerald, he would have said that. So I think these are two different things.
Now, are you working on any new material or new books about your insights on Egypt? I know you've written extensively on it, but is there some next story or next insight that you're getting or you're incubating that? Was 2038 the last one that you wrote on that subject?
Not really. What's been happening lately is I'm writing the book on the secret of the golden flower and how Edgar Cayce's expansive concepts mm-hmm. of our higher mind. Mm-hmm. What is our higher mind like? Mm-hmm. What does it feel like? And Taoism, which is the secret of the golden flower, is mm-hmm. written on the theories of Taoism, fits so well with Edgar's teachings about this that that's what I'm doing. Now, back when I was a young man here, mm-hmm. Hugh Lynn Cayce, Edgar's son, and Herb Puryear, Dr. Herb Puryear, were teaching the secret of the golden flower. Mm-hmm. And so I studied it for like...
And correlating it with Cayce's.
Correlating with yeah. Cayce. And it was a meditative practice as well as a conceptual one. Mm-hmm. So you had to learn to meditate the golden flower way, which used breath and consciousness and all. So that's what I've been working on. And that book will be coming out the 1st of January of next year.
Oh, good.
And I have written most of it, so I was just amazed at Cayce's words being so close to the concepts in the ancient Taoist text. Mm-hmm. So that's been very fascinating. That's where my focus has been lately.
So truth is truth.
Yeah, truth is truth.
Yeah. Good. I think we have a little, maybe one more question, and then we'll have to unfortunately.
How does studying ancient sites or mysteries help with one's soul growth today? Is it simply what resonates with us, and that might provide direction, or is there some other advantage? I think again we have a soul here who intuitively
knows the answer,
knows these things. Mm-hmm. Yes and no. Here's I'll explain it this way. When I was young and first went to Egypt, I was blown away, and when I got back I thought, wow, I just meditated in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. And then I went on the lecture circuit, you know, like mm-hmm. I normally do, and I'm teaching, and I'm thinking, all these souls can't go. And then one night I was praying about that when it occurred to me, oh yeah, they can. The King's Chamber is within them. Mm-hmm. The pyramid is an external stone mm-hmm. replication mm-hmm. of an internal reality. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was the story of Moses that helped me realize this. I was reading that Moses left Egypt. Remember, he was a favorite of Pharaoh. Mm-hmm. He grew up trained in all the Egyptian wisdom, but he left to search for who he truly was and for God. And when he finally meets God in the desert, God teaches him to build a different temple of poles and curtains, and it's portable. It goes with you. Hint, hint. Mm-hmm. And then here comes the disciple Paul along, and he says, don't you realize your body is the temple? And I thought, that's it. These souls, anywhere, they don't have to go to the sites. Anywhere they are, they can tap into this, and it's there for them. Mm-hmm. But like you and I know, if you have an opportunity to go, that's a catalyst. If you come near the original
Definitely.
Vibes, the original zone, or portal, mm-hmm. portal possibly. Mm-hmm. If you come near that original, that will really help you. Mm-hmm. It does resonate, and it does provide direction. And I don't want to say there's an advantage, because really, some person like Edgar who never went can actually have a full experience of the meaning, purpose, and energetics of the ancient incarnation. But at the same time, you and I know it really is a catalyst. If you're in that zone, that adds a lot.
Well said, well put. Uh-huh. So we're going to be wrapping up soon, but just want to give you a moment or two. Any final thoughts that you have, anything you'd like to share just before we end? I hope we'll do this again, but anything about... that's coming to you that we haven't spoken about with Edgar Cayce.
Well, the one thing out of my 50-some years studying these readings and working with them, applying them in my life, mm-hmm. and watching others do that, mm-hmm. and getting feedback from other people, the number one purpose that Edgar conveyed to us is to know yourself to be your true self, and then choose to cooperate with the whole. Mm-hmm. The whole includes others. I am having a personal relationship with my contact with the source of my life, my creator, God, whatever you want to call that source. But that source loves all the others too. And so I think that's why Jesus said the second commandment is like the first. Love God with all your being, mm-hmm. love one another. And it's like the first because they're all part of the whole. And even though they're difficult, mm-hmm. and your relationships can be difficult, it's a two-part journey. Coming to know yourself to be your true self and cooperating with others in the spiritual growth, caring about them, helping. I think that's number one thing. And if you're doing that, you can be in the top of the Himalayan mountains and not know Edgar yeah. Casey from yeah. the man in the moon, and your soul is growing.
Yeah, the whole law, as Casey
yeah,
said.
The whole law is in Good. That.
Well, thank you, John. It's
okay.
been just great having you.
And
we gotta do this again. It's
okay.
great catching up
okay.
with you. I miss our time when we travel together.
Yep.
We gotta do that again.
Yep.
So thank you. This is we're wrapping up Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. Thanks for joining us. Hope to see you again soon.